This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida Governor Rick Scott now says the number of locally acquired Zika cases has climbed to 14. Florida is the first state in the United States to have locally acquired cases of the disease, and so far officials say the transmission is confined to a small area, just 1 square mile north of downtown Miami. Well, Scott's asked the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to activate its emergency response team. Here's Governor Rick Scott.
We'll be working with the FDA and blood establishments in Miami-Dade and Broward counties to test each individual unit of blood collected. Additionally, statewide, we will ensure safe blood for pregnant women by screening units from counties without Zika.
Meanwhile, efforts are being taken to step up spraying and other mosquito controls. Here's Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam.
We also, in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, have task forces which are ready to deploy and provide additional support to those local programs. Those will be boots on the ground in the impacted areas with backpack sprayers, doing surveillance, eliminating habitat of these mosquitoes.
So how are residents reacting to the news, and what kind of impact is it having on the tourists flooding into the state? According to one poll in the Washington Post, only 1 in 3 Americans are worried they or someone in their immediate family could contract the disease. Public health officials in Britain are warning pregnant women to put off non-essential travel to Florida. Here's Governor Scott again on the tourism impact.
The state is prepared, and we've been prepared. We think about this just like we do a hurricane. The way you do well at this is you get ready. We use the same techniques that we use for other mosquito-borne diseases, and we've been very successful at that. We're a tourism state. We continue to welcome families here, but we'll continue to tell people to stay prepared and wear mosquito spray.
Well, joining me from the WLRN studios in Miami is health reporter Sammy Mack, also in the studio here at 90.7, health reporter Abe Abariah. Sammy Mack, I want to start with you. What do we know about the locally acquired Zika cases? Are there any of them, are any of them pregnant women?
From the sounds of it, no. They haven't specifically said I believe in this grouping in Wynwood, one of them is female. 10 of them are male. Sorry, 2 of them are female. The 10 new cases are all male.
Right.
And they have not been talking about the female cases as potentially pregnant women.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that there would be overlap there, but from the sounds of it, I don't think that is the case.
Just give me a sense, if you could, of how Miami residents are reacting to the news.
Kind of a mixed bag. You know, there are people who are really concerned and worried, and those tend to be the people who have a stake in some of the worst outcomes of Zika, which, if you're a pregnant woman, the worst thing that can happen is damage to the baby. And then, you know, there are other parts of the city that are saying, whoa, 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 calm down. You know, we got an email press alert from the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau Center that, you know, the beaches are open, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of people on the tourism side of things who are stressing, it's just 1 square mile. It's just 1 square mile. So, you know, don't be afraid to visit our parts of Miami.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the sort of realization that this is here and it may be here for a little while is starting to sink in.
Abe Abariah, let me bring you in on this conversation. Talk to me about how the federal government is working with Florida to help control this outbreak. What kind of help, for a start, is Florida asking for?
Well, this is they're getting what's called a CDC Emergency Response Team, or a CERT. This is a group of, I want to say, 8 people that are coming to Florida. This is in addition to the one CDC official that was here previously. These are kind of colloquially known as the disease hunter groups. So they're going to be getting help in the sense of obviously more help from logistics and from people from the CDC, and then also lab testing expertise, these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have the people that are going to be doing these hunts to try and see if there's more Zika going on and sort of figure out, you know, why they're having such a hard time controlling it in this area as well.
Is this a typical timeline for when federal officials get involved in a state outbreak of a disease?
Well, there's been Reuters actually had a very interesting piece over the weekend before Rick Scott had actually called in for the CERT team to come in, basically saying that it was, Florida was asking for the CDC's help, but it was sort of keeping them at an arm's length. So I think that's going to be one of the questions that, you know, is going to come up as we kind of go forward with this is, you know, should the state of Florida actually have brought, you know, asked for this, you know, disease hunter team sooner. Mm-hmm. You know, that's going to be one of those Monday morning quarterback sort of scenarios where we're going to be looking back. But a lot of the epidemiologists that they were quoting in that story were saying, you know, time is really of the essence when you're looking at something like this and containing it. Now, the sort of flip side of that is Florida, you know, Florida as a state has dealt with chikungunya and dengue fever, these other mosquito-borne diseases from the Aedes aegypti before. They've managed to control those outbreaks to, you know, relatively small numbers in the past. So, you know, maybe there's sort of a sense that, you know, Florida can handle it on its own, you know, with the things we have in place already.
Mm-hmm. What kind of other help could the federal government offer to the state of Florida?
Well, obviously, funding would be the biggest thing. That's, you know, Congress has gone to recess
right.
without the $1.9 billion that the Obama administration has asked for this. You know, we've seen calls from, you know, Senator Bill Nelson to come back, you know, for Congress to reconvene to deal with the funding for this. We've also seen other congressmen, mm-hmm. John Mica, for example.
I think Senator Marco Rubio is doing that call too.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, we're seeing others as well on the congressional side. We're saying, you know, that the CDC should be freeing up some of the money from Ebola that was the emergency funding and using that as well. But I can tell you, you know, when the U.S. Surgeon General and the head of Health and Human Services were in Orlando last week, they pretty much said that, you know, we've found all the money we can. We're tapped out. You know, Florida has got a $26 million in emergency funding that Rick Scott will probably be using almost exclusively for Zika. You know, HHS has freed up $5 million, a little bit more than that for the state as well. But so the funding thing would definitely be one thing we could see from the federal government, and then also from you know, the vaccine side as well, just sort of more long term.
Mm-hmm. Sammy Mack, I wonder if I could turn back to you, and I want to ask you, what are health officials telling pregnant women and their healthcare providers now that there are local cases in South Florida in that area of Miami?
Well, the big message to pregnant women is don't get bit by mosquitoes. Which is hard to do when you live in South Florida and it's summer and it's rainy. So there's kind of a couple layers of things that are happening. One, they're telling them to wear your long sleeves and long pants and cover up and wear your mosquito repellent, preferably DEET or one of the other ones that has been proven to actually work. Mm-hmm. 'Cause there's stuff out there that is not tested. And then for the providers, the recommendations are now changing. So we heard yesterday that women who have traveled to this little affected area should be talking to their doctors about potentially getting screened if they live in that area. And there are women who live in that area who are pregnant, mm-hmm. that they should be getting screened for the virus. And before this, the recommendation was only if they had traveled to a place outside of the U.S. Or in Puerto Rico that had an active outbreak. But now that sort of guideline is also being applied to women who have traveled to this neighborhood in Miami.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing a big increase in spraying and other kind of control efforts in Miami?
Yeah, we are. I just read today that apparently the mosquito department, or the sort of boots on the ground part of the mosquito department, has gone from 12 people to they're hiring 32. Or building the ranks up to 32, because part of the issue with this is that you can't really do aerial spraying for this kind of mosquito. It is really well adapted to breed in kind of tucked away little tiny pockets of water, like a bottle cap turned upside down could breed apparently up to 300 mosquitoes. So what's tough about it is that you need people with backpacks going through and turning things over and looking under flower pots and getting in the areas that, you know, if you're a homeowner, you can do what you can on your own property, but you can't control mosquitoes in an entire county.
Mm-hmm. Abe, just in the last 30 seconds or so, I want to ask you, I mean, it sounds like it's quite a tough mosquito to control. Is that why we're seeing authorities having trouble really getting a handle on this at this stage?
You know, that's one of the big questions right now is, you know, they're doing these aggressive mosquito control tactics in the Wynwood area. And, you know, we heard from the CDC yesterday that it's not working and they don't know why. They don't know if potentially the mosquitoes are developing a resistance. They don't know if You know, because of the mixed use urban areas, you know, maybe there are pockets they can't find, or, you know, maybe this is just sort of the nature of the beast with the Aedes aegypti mosquito that, you know, they're trying to get them and they're not getting them all, and it's going to continue to transmit that way.
Well, Abe Abarrar is 90.7's health reporter. Thank you so much for joining us, Abe.
Thank you for having me.
Sammy Mack is WLRN's health reporter. She joined us from WLRN studios in Miami. Thank you so much, Sammy.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, what's the role of zoos and species conservation? A conversation at the Central Florida Zoo. Later in the program, too, we revisit a conversation with up-and-coming singer-songwriter Lainey Jones, and we hear a performance from Lainey and her band as well. That's when Intersection returns in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. The elephants have retired from Ringling Circus, and SeaWorld is refocusing its mission on conservation. As public awareness about animal welfare grows, conservation's a word you'll hear a lot at zoos as well. To find out more about what the Central Florida Zoo is doing to help endangered species, here's an encore of my conversation earlier this year with Stephanie Williams, the zoo's Director of Education.
We actually occupy over 100 acres, of which over 24 of it is developed currently. A lot of it's on wetlands, and so we want to protect that easement. We have over 200 species of animals, and they represent animals from around the world. So we have from inverts all the way up to the large mammals like our Indian rhinos.
We're looking at a couple of these rhinos right now.
Yes, we are. These are two male Indian rhinoceros found in Asia.
Are these endangered, these animals?
They are. These guys, there's actually three species of Asian rhinos, all of which are endangered. Most people are familiar with the black and white rhinos of Africa, and very few people realize that there's actually rhinos that are found in Asia.
So how many of the animal species that you have here are in that category? They're either in trouble or critical as far as the habitat goes, surviving in the wild?
Majority of the animals that we have here at our facility are classified as either endangered or threatened or vulnerable. We participate in the Species Survival Plan through AZA, which is the American Zoological Association, and we have over 34 different species that participate in that breeding program.
So what exactly is that? Just give me a sense of what the program is and what it does.
Sure. The SSP program, Species Survival Plan, each species in that program is going to have a coordinator who works with all the facilities, all the institutions or organizations that participate in that program for that species. And basically that program is it's a breeding program. It helps to make sure that the population within North American zoos is genetically diverse. And that way we have this population that can continue out, even though there's species like these guys that are in trouble in the wild, we still have them here within North America, and we can do field research, we can do conservation, we can do studies here, as well as send individuals and staff into the wild to study them.
Do any of the animals that are at this zoo or maybe other zoos across North America, do any of them ever make it back to the wild, or is this the final home for them?
Well, the majority of the animals that are found in zoos and aquariums today are born in zoos and aquariums. Through programs like the Species Survival Plans, the SSPs, there are some programs that are geared for reintroduction, and so there have been some species that have been able to be reintroduced into the wild. Not all programs are geared like that. It depends on how well the animal is doing in the wild, what are the conditions in the wild, what kind of conservation work needs to be done in terms of education and research.
As far as these rhinos go, I mean, you hear about elephant tusks being harvested by poachers. Does the same thing happen with rhino horns as well?
It does. So one of the threats to these guys in terms of poaching for their horn, for medicinal value, the horns can be turned into weapons, things like that. And so they are poached. There's also loss of habitat, fragmentation, that also affects these guys.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can give me an idea of maybe how the role of zoos might be changing. Like, Are zoos today significantly different from what they would have been sort of 10, 20, even 30 years ago?
Sure. If you look back through the history of zoos and how they started in aquariums, a lot of it was for an entertainment factor. People would come see the animals. And today, the role has changed significantly. It is really about conservation, not only the work that we're doing here in North America, but also how our work can affect conservation and education in the wild for these animals and help protecting them from becoming extinct. So it's really about conservation and education. We do a lot of programs here that will help children who don't have that ability to travel to Africa and throughout North America or South America and see these animals out in the wild. And so they get to learn what they can do to help these guys, whether they're out shopping and being a consumer and buying resources that might affect these guys in the wild, or just even understanding that recycling and polluting our oceans is something that we need to, you know, care about and protect. In some of our programs, we allow contact with the animals. The ability to go up and feed a giraffe is priceless. Not many people get that opportunity, or to go behind the scenes and touch a rhino. It's that contact that allows them to say, I want to be able to help animals and to grow up protecting these guys.
What about this idea that the zoos, you know, whether it's this one or whether it's other ones, are kind of like a Noah's Ark of species, that one day they're, you know, there might not be any habitat for these animals out in the wild, or, you know, they may be so threatened because of poaching or other things that they just can't survive on their own. Is that something that you think about as the future of zoos?
I think we all do. Coming from working here, I've been here for over 16 years, and that is a fact that we do live with, that every day we have reports of elephants, you know, 96 elephants being killed every day is a horrible thought. And for us to think about that maybe in the future we're only going to be able to see elephants in a facility that's not the wild is kind of heartbreaking, I think. And so we want to make sure that we're doing all that we can to understand how we can stop that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you folks here at the Central Florida Zoo used to have an elephant or two, right?
We did, yep. We used to have two female Asian elephants.
So what happened to them?
Our female elephants, we had one that was an older female. She was 63 years old. She did pass away from old age. And her remaining counterpart was moved to another facility to join a larger herd, because we do not, it's part of our standards not to keep an elephant by itself. They are a, they live in a herd society, and she needed to be with a larger herd.
And there's been a lot of publicity around zoos in general. When you talk about elephants, sometimes there's controversy over, you know, should these large animals be kept for people to look at? Is that kind of a tricky path for zoos to negotiate?
It is. We want to make sure that, you know, the number one thing is providing the best care possible for these animals. And again, remembering that these animals, they were born in human care and they have not been taken out of the wild. And so we just want to make sure that they're growing from young to adult, they're getting the best care possible, and also that we're participating in those conservation and education programs.
And you folks have a lot of land here, and as you said, some of it's wetland, so you want to preserve that, but I guess you've got room to expand if you need to?
We do. We are currently working on expanding in the near future, adding in some educational facilities, adding in some larger habitats, and kind of remodeling the scope of the zoo.
But it must be quite expensive to maintain all that. I mean, it looks like you're doing some work here. You've got some new fences going up, but just kind of keeping the stuff all shipshape must cost a bit.
It does. So a majority of the funding that we utilize here at the zoo is from our gate, so it's general attendance. And then we do work with donations, donors, sponsors, grants, all help to run the zoo. But animal care is definitely the number one expense here that we have. The staff and the amount of care and work to build the facility and to build the habitats that these animals need, and to hire the staff that need to take care of them.
What got you involved in this line of work? What motivated you to want to do this as a career?
Mine has been a love of animals. I went to school to actually study animals in the wild, and I did for a little bit. But it was also my love of educating young children specifically, just seeing their faces light up when they see the animals. And it's been really important, so I've kind of married the two. So that conservation side, that studying of animals out in the field, and then how we can inspire guests on an everyday basis to learn about these magnificent creatures.
So you've seen some of these animals out in their natural habitat.
I have. Yep, I've been fortunate to travel throughout Florida, to travel to Africa. It's quite the experience to see them roaming their wild areas.
Just on that Florida note, I mean, there are quite a few wild animals here in Florida, and you'll see them sometimes inadvertently. And I guess there's, you know, there's people moving to Florida every day, so there's a lot of development going on. Do you get the sense that we're going to see more of the animals you might have just been able to see on your, you know, morning commute or something in zoos in the future because their habitat's disappearing too?
We have already started to see that. There's right now we're working with an endangered or a threatened species called the eastern indigo snake. Throughout its history, you used to be able to find it throughout Florida, and they would live in gopher tortoise burrows and in dry habitat. Well, that habitat is where we tend to develop most in terms of housing and residential areas, and so over time that population has decreased. And so our zoo, in partnership with Atlanta Zoo and Auburn University and some other facilities, we've been working to save that species, and we're currently in the process of doing reintroductions of the snake up in Georgia and northern Florida. So it's pretty important for us.
And I guess at least if it's a native species here in Florida or the United States, you know there is a chance that it could be back in the wild.
Correct, right. We're able to go out into the field and kind of take a census of what's happening in the native habitat here in Florida and then how we can work to reintroduce these species in the future.
That was Stephanie Williams, Director of Education for the Central Florida Zoo in Sanford, in an interview that first aired in March. Still to come, Lainey Jones performs a selection of songs from her latest album. That's when Intersection returns. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Lainey Jones is the songwriter and frontwoman of Lainey Jones and the Spirits. Born in Maryland, she grew up in Mount Dora. She and her band were recently featured by Rolling Stone magazine, which named her one of the 10 new country artists you need to know. Earlier this year, she released a new album titled Lainey Jones, and she joined us in the studio with two of her band members, Matthew Tonner and Trey Hester. Here's a track from one of their earlier albums. It's called Broken Hearts.
Larry, you used to shine in the sun. As you did in ancient times, life had just begun. Flower you used to grow high above the rest. Now you're in a mason jar facing towards the west. Broken hearts are always aching. Weary eyes chase the past. Only they can turn back time to make the moment last. Spring is coming on. Smell the sweet perfume from your window. Only they can turn back time.
Well, Lainey Jones, thank you so much for coming in and joining us.
Oh, thanks for having us, Matthew.
So start by describing your music. Does it fit into a convenient category? Are you kind of branching out now?
I'm definitely branching out, at least on this new album. We like to call it Retro Majestic. I have a lot of sort of, I guess, just older influences. Obviously, like, country is a big part of it, but also, too, I really love, you know, music from the 60s and 70s. I mean, 70s Bob Dylan, like, Neil Young is all really super rad to me. Also, like, even rock bands like, you know, Velvet Underground, I think, are really interesting, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, combine all those elements to create something that is, I think, a little more lush than what I've done before, rich in textures, at least on this new album. And also, too, is a, not really like a throwback, but it has a vibe of being maybe in a little bit from another era, a past era.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that era has been totally mined of all the material that's in there, or are there still things that people now are yet to discover, or things you can kind of turn and sort of make a new sound out of it?
Well, I guess, you know, it's sort of my revolt, you know, to, I guess, you know, modern music seems a little bit just awash of personality and imperfections. And I think what's really cool about the older music is that a lot of times they were all doing live tracking. So, you know, you hear like little keyboards are out of tune or just little things here and there, but it feels so alive and present. And that's what I really love about sort of that time frame, at least in the recording aspect.
So is that how you record? You do it live and then kind of leave some of those little imperfections in there?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of moments on recording this album that they're all played by live instruments. Every sound you hear, it was made by an actual human being and not a computer. So there's definitely moments, too, where, like, oh, I didn't, you know, think to hit that note, or, you know, somebody accidentally hit something on their, like, guitar. I know there's definitely some moments that they stayed because they sounded cool, but it was just an accidental happy mistake.
Is that sometimes a point of conflict if you're working with a producer? Like, do you sometimes have a producer say, look, we need to make it, you know, sound a little slicker, or how what's that like, kind of putting that together?
Well, with the producer that I worked with, Dave Plakin, he just kind of came into the experience with a really open mind, and I think that's the kind of person that I want to be working with in the studio is, you know, you don't want to shut yourself off to how it's supposed to be. As far, you know, because then you're just cutting off your creativity and leaving out all the possibilities that you don't even know.
Mm-hmm. Now, the song you just played, Broken Hearts,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was from your first album?
Yes. Well, it's technically my second album. It's my first studio album that I recorded here locally. And it was one of the first songs I actually ever collaborated with Matthew over here.
So tell me a little bit about the song. What kind of makes it special? Is it something that people, you know, yell out for when you're doing a concert?
Yeah, actually. It's one of the songs that I think I've gotten the most sort of airplay from, at least from all the stuff that I've done before this new album. I got to play it on at the Kennedy Center, on Great Performances on PBS. It's just one of those songs that I feel like, you know, people are really connect to for some reason. It comes from a personal place for me. I wrote the song for my mom after my grandma had passed away. And, you know, it was also, as I said, one of the first songs I really collaborated with someone else on. So I feel like you sort of get your own little flaws are taken out of the song, and you sort of have to persuade the other person, like, what makes this song really special? How can we make it the best? So I think that's the collaborative nature of that helps, I think, elevate your songwriting sometimes.
Do you have people, I mean, everybody's going to hear something different in the song, right? Has anybody come up to you and said, well, I think that song, you know, tells me something completely different? Like, have you had people say that they have a different interpretation of the song and that makes you kind of think differently about how you play it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not on that particular song I've gotten that, but on one song that I have, it was one of my earlier songs, it's called Midnight Snack, and it's about, I have goats out where I lived, and we actually pulled out the largest female alligator in the state of Florida from my backyard, and she ate 5 of my goats, and so it's like Midnight Snack talking about the sort of cruelty of nature. But one person thought it could be about politics, and how, like, there's sort of this dog-eat-dog world out there, and you know, the big man gator is going to try to get you. You know.
Did that happen recently?
It happened a few years ago. Unfortunately, we don't have any more goats left. We had the goats. We had like a whole herd of them, probably about 30 of them. And they just kind of slowly dwindled away from water moccasins, gators. Florida panther got one with babies one time. It's really rough, you know.
Rough being a goat.
Yep, in Florida at least.
What about the alligators? Is that still around?
Fish and Animal Wildlife had to take a couple of them out mm-hmm. of the water. Because once they start getting goats, they could kind of go after small children or a dog or anything. And
right.
that can get kind of dangerous. So they had to take them out, unfortunately. But I know they're still lurking out there. I lived out on Lake Jim area, and so it's on the chain of lakes. So there's definitely some gators still lurking around there for sure.
Mm-hmm. Was that kind of a tough experience? Did you be able to sort of channel some of that? It must be pretty upsetting. I was obviously losing your goats, but you're able to sort of channel that creatively and turn that into a good song?
Absolutely. It was one of those things that, you know, I told some friends, and another songwriter in a local sort of coffee house thing. I was telling that story, and she was like, "You should write a song about it." And I was like, "That's a brilliant idea." So I went home that day and wrote the song. And too, you know, I feel like, of course, you know, you take any personal experience and try to, you know, create it into something. You know, everything is copy in a way. So just try to turn that that negativity into something positive.
And that makes a uniquely country song too. I'm not sure that I can think of any other country songs involving an alligator and some goats.
It's a very Florida song for sure.
Well, would you like to play another song?
Do you guys want to play Work It Out?
Sure.
All right. This is a happy little song.
Alrighty, so that's a song from your new album?
Yeah, it is, yep.
And you're on the ukulele for this?
I am, yeah. I jump back and forth between ukulele, guitar, when we're playing electrified, and a banjo, of course.
Now, was banjo the first instrument you started playing?
Well, I guess, you know, voice was really the first instrument. I started that when I was just a youngin'. But I really didn't get into playing instruments until I was older in college. And, I dabbled in piano some, but I would say guitar would probably be first. But the banjo is the instrument that I just felt super connected to. And it came from playing ukulele because they're both four strings, so it sort of connects. The chord shapes are pretty similar. But I don't know, it's just the sound of the banjo. I just connected to it right away.
How old were you when you started playing?
I guess I was 19, and I'm 24 now.
It's got four strings. Is it a complex instrument to play?
It depends. I have five strings on this, and that the fifth string can be sort of the downfall of most people because it starts halfway up the neck and it's tuned super high, and so a lot of times people are like, how do I incorporate this into the playing? And I sort of played around for it by myself for about a year, just sort of figuring out little things I could do. But it wasn't until I met Mark Johnson. He's a banjo player out of Florida up north. I think DeLand and Dinellen. Thank you. And he plays clawhammer banjo, and so I sort of developed that style. And it's a little more percussive, and it's a lot older style. You're sort of bouncing off the fifth string with your thumb, and you kind of make a claw shape with your hand as you play it. So I'm kind of glad to adopt that different technique. It allows me to sort of do a little different things than what you normally think with banjo.
So, Lainey Jones, you were brought up in Mount Dora on a 10-acre farm with all kinds of animals. I've read exotic animals like wallabies and kangaroos, as well as those goats, of course. What kind of influence do you think that upbringing had on the music you make now?
So I tell a story sometimes that when I was a kid, you sort of get like psychological testing to make sure you're okay to go into preschool and stuff like that. And the doctor had sort of asked me what a fence was. I was like, it holds in my kangaroos. And he thought I was crazy. So I actually got mental testing for about a week to make sure I was, you know, everything was okay and I wasn't just seeing things. But I think, you know, it kind of made me realize there's more than just one way to be in life. There's more possibilities as far as like, oh, you can have a dog for a pet, you can have a cat, or you can have a kangaroo, or, you know, a mouse, a gerbil, you know, it doesn't matter. Just, you know, everybody's sort of living their life their own way, and it's okay. It's cool. Be cool with that.
So does that give you some more kind of freedom in the way you make music? Like, you feel like you're not just confined to one category of music making?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that's a big part, I think, of who I am. I like to explore a lot of different music because I love a lot of different music. I listen to the radio because of that. Usually, you know, at least with the independent stations, you know, you can find a great mix in sort of what you're listening to. And I think that's kind of too why like younger generations more into like the iTunes or like Spotify is because you can kind of create your own playlist, and that's like more exciting than just being fed the same thing over and over again.
So do you still have a lot of animals out where you live?
No, we just have dogs. And the crazy thing is too, when I was a kid, I just wanted a dog. I didn't want a kangaroo because I had a few losses in my life where a dog had swam across like the sort of river where we lived and actually killed my kangaroo. So I was a really super depressed young child. I was like, happened to me when I was 3 or 4. And so that, I think that also sort of influenced my dad said I have like a soft spot in my heart. And I told like my first grade teacher that I was going to go get an operation, get it cut out. So I think I'm more of the sensitive type, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you like to play us out on a final song?
Oh, absolutely. We'll play on a nice little love song. It's called My Troubled Mind.
One, two, three, four. Thank you.
not seen the light. Had a theory that I would grow weary with nobody at my side. Now that I found you, won't say goodbye, and I couldn't leave you and don't wanna try. Happiness or maybe for fools, but baby, I'm the foolish kind. Next to you these days I dream in color. All the world you waits to be discovered. Thanks to you I think I've changed my troubled mind.
You've been listening to Lainey Jones and the Spirits. That's Lainey Jones, Matthew Tonner, and Trey Hester. The new album is titled Lainey Jones. Lainey Jones, of course, named by Rolling Stone one of the 10 new country artists you need to know. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
That interview first aired on Intersection in March. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Production assistance for today's show from Abe Abariah. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.